This is Access Utah. I'm Sherry Quinn.
The world's oceans are largely unprotected, and the global fishing stocks are in serious trouble from overfishing and pollution. Joining us to talk about ocean conservation is Michael Sutton, Vice President of the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. There, he is director of the Center for the Future of the Oceans. He got started on this work in landlocked Utah.
My undergraduate work was at Utah State back in the mid-1970s. I went straight from Utah State to graduate school and a career basically in wildlife conservation. Never looked back.
The Monterey Bay Aquarium is 26 years old. It was founded in 1984. Its mission is to inspire conservation of the oceans. Sutton explains how it differs from other conservation groups.
Well, one of the differences is we have both an attraction brand and an authority brand. Most conservation groups just have an authority brand. They don't have any bricks and mortar. But we have nearly 2 million people a year who visit the Monterey Bay Aquarium and fall in love with the oceans and the animals and plants within them. And those people expect us to take care of the animals and plants and habitats they've fallen in love with. And so we do that. We take advantage of the fact that we are one of the most trusted voices on ocean issues in the United States to try to move the needle on ocean conservation issues in Sacramento, that is to say within California, in Washington, D.C. at the national level. And in some cases, we work internationally on species like tunas that migrate across ocean basins.
How much of the ocean is protected compared to land?
About 10% of the United States land surface is protected in one way or another. National parks, state parks, wildlife refuges, game refuges, and so forth, state and federal. About 10% of the land surface is set aside for conservation in one form or another. But what most people don't realize is that less than 1% of the ocean of our oceans are similarly protected. The United States, believe it or not, has the biggest ocean area under its jurisdiction of any country in the world. We may not be the biggest country in the world, but we have the most ocean. Because remember, during World War II, we took a number of islands in the Pacific and we retained jurisdiction of them. So, and every one of those islands, under the Law of the Sea Treaty, has a 200-mile ring around it in which the United States exercises authority and jurisdiction. So, we have a lot of ocean under our authority, and less than 1% of it has been protected in a similar fashion as the land. So what we're trying to do, among other things here in California, is to level the playing field between the oceans and the land. We think that about as much of the oceans ought to be protected as our land surface. It doesn't mean we're against fishing or against using the ocean. It just means that we ought to safeguard our ocean ecosystems so that they can provide us with the services that we've come to expect, such as seafood and recreational fishing and so forth.
So it really is important for the U.S. to take a leadership role in conserving the ocean.
It really is. Oceans are the majority of our planet. If you were an alien and you saw the Earth for the first time, you wouldn't call it planet Earth. You would call it planet ocean because that's what it mostly is, salt water. The trouble is we live on the land, and so we tend to pay more attention to the land than the ocean. But in fact, oceans are more than 70% of our planet. We have ignored them. We've dumped things into them. We've taken lots of things that we've overfished. We've built around the edges too much and not in a thoughtful manner. So we've abused our oceans. They've been out of sight, out of mind for many years. And we now are beginning to realize we have a responsibility to take care of them and to safeguard them from the abuses of the past.
And what species are the most threatened in terms of the fishing industry, and how are the bluefin tuna doing?
We have unfortunately not managed many of our marine fisheries very well. Fisheries on land we've done a better job of because they're closer to home. But our marine fisheries, we used to think the oceans were going to feed the world. And we realize now that the oceans are finite because a lot of species live right up into the coastal margins within the first 3, 4, 5 miles of the shore. And we have been very successful at depleting them. In fact, if you look at the history of our fishery management in our United States oceans, you can sum up our track record in two words, serial depletion. We have depleted one species after the other in our quest for seafood, and we all love seafood. I love seafood too, don't get me wrong. I'm not against eating seafood by any means. But we have to recognize that seafood is different than most other foods that we eat. Seafood is the last example of market hunting in the United States. We used to hunt wild animals on land for food. We stopped that in the turn of the last century. We replaced hunting with farming as the source of our food supply. But in the oceans, we still hunt. We still fish on a commercial basis for food. And there's nothing wrong with that, but at least we ought to do it on a sustainable basis so that we don't deplete the fisheries that sustain our coastal environments and our coastal communities. So that's been the problem in the past. Bluefin tuna is the poster child of overfishing. The bluefin tuna, I used to call it the Porsche of the oceans because it's as big as a Porsche. The animal can weigh 1,500 pounds. It's as fast as a Porsche, 0 to 60 in, 4 seconds. And it's as expensive as a Porsche. In Japan, where the principal market is for bluefin tuna sushi and sashimi, one tuna can fetch more than $100,000 U.S. So this is the world's most valuable fish. It's the world's most endangered fish from overfishing as a result. We can do better than that. We know how to do better than that. We just have to have the resolve, and we have to care enough to do better than that. So we're starting to see more and more people care about choosing the right seafood, choosing seafood to eat seafood from fisheries that are well-managed or aquaculture operations, fish farms that are well-managed. And our Seafood Watch program here at the aquarium has had remarkable success in the last decade.
And can you give some examples of those successes?
Our salmon fishery in Alaska has been well-managed. It's abundant. We put Alaska salmon on our green list of the Seafood Watch card. Our Seafood Watch card has a red, green, and a yellow list. The green list are the best choices, fisheries and fish farms that are well-managed, the species are abundant, fishing methods don't destroy the ecosystem. The red list, on the other hand, are the fisheries, the seafood that we recommend that consumers avoid because those species have problems. They're overfished or they're fished by destructive fishing techniques like bottom trawls or long lines that catch a lot of other species that are unintended. And on that list are species like sharks and tunas and others that are in trouble. And then there's the yellow list, which are good alternatives, not perfect, but good alternatives. And the whole idea is to provide an incentive in the marketplace for fishery managers to do better, and for fisheries to transition from the red list to the yellow list to the green. And fortunately, consumers have really responded. Our Seafood Watch program has been an unmitigated success over the last decade. It's something that you and I can do in our own lives. We can vote with our wallet in the seafood restaurant or in the seafood counter at the supermarket and make better choices for the environment. And it turns out those fish on the green list are often the least contaminated. So not only are we making a better choice for the environment, we're making a better choice for ourselves and our health. And that's really important to most people.
Does that list change very often? And what are some species that are on the list, the green list?
Well, it does change often. And I have five or six scientists on my staff who spend their living making changes and recommending changes and updates to the Seafood Watch pocket guides and our seafood recommendations. We want to make sure they're underpinned by the best available science. The green list includes species that everyone loves, like Dungeness crab, the wonderful crab of the California coast. Again, a well-managed fishery. It's a trap fishery, so there's very little bycatch or damage to the environment. It's well-managed and abundant. It includes species like Alaska salmon, sockeye salmon, which is a much better choice than farmed salmon. Farmed salmon is imported. It is contaminated often with pesticides and antibiotics. So if you see Atlantic salmon, that's your cue that it's farmed salmon, and that it's not as good a choice as wild Alaska salmon. If you go to Whole Foods or one of the retailers that carries wild salmon and you ask for wild Alaska salmon, you're making a better choice for the environment. It's tastier and it's better for you because it's not as contaminated as farmed salmon. And the price point is pretty much similar these days. Wild salmon might be a couple dollars a pound more, but it's well worth the investment. And there are lots of examples of fisheries on the green list. Many farmed shellfish, for example, are on the green list because shellfish farming is a very sustainable practice. Shellfish leave the water cleaner than it started. Remember, they're filter feeders. There's no damage to the ocean environment by shellfish farming. So farmed oysters, farmed clams, and mussels are a great choice as well.
And what about shrimp? There are a lot of shrimp farms, I understand.
Shrimp is a good question. Shrimp is the number one seafood in the United States and every other market around the world that cares about seafood. Shrimp is one-third of the value of the entire U.S. seafood industry. shrimp is seafood to most people. We love our shrimp. I always thought if we asked people to boycott shrimp, they would boycott us instead, because we Americans love our shrimp, and I love shrimp as much as the next person. The trouble is, it's really difficult to produce shrimp in an environmentally sustainable manner, because if you catch them, they're often caught, they're usually caught by bottom trawling, which is a very destructive fishing practice, and it actually brings up to 5 to 10 pounds of other animals and plants for every 1 pound of shrimp that come up in the trawl. So that's problematic. If you try to farm shrimp, many shrimp farms are built in mangrove forests where the forests are cut down, destroying nursery habitat for fisheries in the area in favor of shrimp farms. It's like slash and burn aquaculture. So shrimp are really problematic from a sustainable seafood perspective because it's hard to find acceptable sources of shrimp, either farmed or wild. We do have, however, some shrimp farms and shrimp fishing that is conducted better than others. And that's really a relative thing with respect to shrimp. So the best thing to do is go to seafoodwatch.org, download a Seafood Watch card, and look for sources of shrimp that are on the green or the yellow list. There are a few, but it's a matter of doing your homework and finding out which are the best sources. If you go to the retailers that have embraced the Seafood Watch program, like Whole Foods and like certain restaurants, and you ask them, I want to order shrimp that's acceptable from an environmental perspective. The more people who do that, the more the restaurants and the retailers will join the program and get up to speed on these issues. And if you're met with a blank stare, shop somewhere else is the best advice. Because nowadays, a lot of retailers and restaurants are aware of these issues and are spending more time themselves offering better choices to consumers.
So shrimp is actually one of the more difficult ones then.
Most of the shrimp you will find served at restaurants or in receptions or sold in the market are farmed shrimp from Asia. It's a very big industry. It's a very destructive industry. It's also a very contaminated product. I've been to shrimp farms in Thailand and India and Ecuador and the main countries that export to the United States, and I've seen how much pesticides they use and antibiotics, because remember, they're growing shrimp in these crowded ponds, and the potential for disease is very great. So they use a lot of pesticides and antibiotics to combat disease, and of course, all of that goes into the shrimp and is passed right along to us. I love shrimp, but you better believe I'm very selective at the shrimp that I eat.
The green revolution in the mid-20th century spread existing technologies and industrialized agriculture. Food came from farms and no longer from hunting wild animals. The same transition is now happening with the ocean.
Last year, for the first time, more of our seafood on a global basis came from farming than it did from fishing. It suggested we're making exactly the same transition in our oceans that we made on land. We're moving from hunting to farming. The green revolution on land had enormous negative consequences for the environment, even though we fed billions more people. Our challenge in the oceans is to make sure that as we make that transition from fishing to fish farming, that we do it in a manner that is a net gain or positive for our ocean environment and our coastal environment. Because we can't afford to repeat the same mistakes we made in the green revolution. Right. It's important to have seafood for the future, but it's important to produce seafood in a manner that doesn't trash the marine environment, because if we do that, pretty soon we're not going to have much seafood left.
What are the responses from the fishing industries to going to more fish farms? And do you see that as a positive trend, as long as we can do it in a sustainable way? And
it is not a matter of whether we think it's a good idea or whether we like it. It's happening, and it's accelerating. Fish farming is proliferating at an exponential pace. It's the fastest growing sector of the international food industry. So we're not going to stop aquaculture, and we don't want to stop aquaculture. It's fine to get our seafood from farms, just like we get our food on land from farms and ranches. But it's how you farm on land and in the oceans that matters. And so our challenge is to green the blue revolution. The blue revolution is that transition from fishing to farming in the ocean. We can farm our seafood in in a manner that doesn't damage the marine environment. We know how to do that. It may be more expensive, but that's the price of doing business. And we don't want to destroy the ecosystem on which our seafood depends. You asked about fishermen. Most fishermen nowadays are just worried about staying in business because in most of our, around our coasts in the United States, most of our ports have become less fishing ports and more tourist attractions. Certainly it's the case here where I live in Monterey. As Bruce Babbitt used to say when he was Secretary of the Interior, the Western economy is shifting from extraction to attraction. If you look right there in Utah, it's not an economy anymore based on just grazing and mining and timber. It's an economy based on attraction, skiing, hiking, backpacking, ecotourism of one form or another. And it's the same here on the California coast. Our economy is no longer based on fishing as it was 100 years ago when sardines were king here in Cannery Row and in Monterey. Not anymore. Ecotourism is king here.
There is a thriving illegal and unregulated pirate fishing problem, and it is causing coastal communities across the globe more than $4 billion each year.
One of the problems with our ocean environment is that it's so vast, it's hard to police. 70% of the planet means that a lot of parts of the ocean are out of sight and out of mind and beyond the reach of authorities, even beyond the reach of naval forces. And so you get situations in which pirate fishing plays a huge role in providing seafood for the international market. The best example of that, perhaps, is Chilean sea bass, otherwise known as Patagonian toothfish. Chilean sea bass has been a favorite of seafood consumers for many years for good reason. It's delicious. These choices matter, and eating lower on the food chain is one of the things we can do to help the oceans.
That was Michael Sutton, Vice President of Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. On the hawk, unstrung, don't you hear my voice? Come true the music. Would you hold it near? As it were your own, it's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are
support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2. Celebrating St. Patrick's Day this week with a signature Reuben sandwich, hand-decorated sugar cookies, and this Thursday through Saturday with Irish soda bread.
Welcome to Barn Yarns, an adventure into the life and times of Utah State University's historic Aggie Barn, a landmark building in Cache Valley. The Aggie Barn, built as a horse barn in 1919, has since undergone several transformations to provide offices and workspaces for professors, scientists, artists, and their various departments. It is now being totally refurbished to house the new Utah State University Welcome Center and Museum of Anthropology. To celebrate the legacy of the Aggie Barn, we've collected stories and unexpected anecdotal moments from many individuals who have spent a part of their past in the barn. In the end, we not only learn about the heritage of the Aggie Barn, but also about ourselves. When the original Utah State University horse barn was torn down in 1919, a new barn was built that still finds itself in the middle of the USU campus. Now called the Aggie Barn, this structure was cutting edge for its time, representing the spirit of agricultural innovation at Utah State University and in Cache Valley. Its gambrel roof and Jackson Fork allowed hay to be stored conveniently in the loft, and its cement floor was easy to clean. Like many other historic structures in Cache Valley, the Aggie Barn's functions changed over time. Alice Carden Crockett is one person who has seen the barn in several of its transformations. As a child living just west of campus in the 1940s, she played in the barn and explored the entire agricultural complex at the time.
And at that time, it was a straight shot through what is now the Institute of Religion parking garage. That was a field with alfalfa. You could go straight through to the barn. I had a basket on my maroon Schwinn bicycle, and I would just load up with alfalfa, put it in my basket, and toward the mouth of the canyon is where the horses were. And the horses were stalled and corralled at what is now the art barn.
Alice loved horses, and one horse that caught her eye and her heart was a large stud named Hugh Dandy, who lived in the barn.
He was copper-colored like a new penny, and he had a white blaze, and he was large. And so he was my horse. And whenever you have a copper-colored horse with a white blaze down the front of their face, and they've got pizzazz, and they move around, oh, your heart just falls in love with them.
Alice also talked about the general feel of the Utah State University campus back then.
Well, everybody was so nice. Everybody understood that kids are kids, and this is what they do. We thought we were welcome everywhere.
In the 1950s, the animals were moved away, and the artists moved in. The barn became a place for throwing pottery and doing other art. Its name back then became known as the Art Barn.
By the time I went there to throw pots, they had removed all those facades of the stalls, but it was still, I'm sure, the same pad, you know, that we were throwing pots on. It was magical over there. You went in there and you could do good things.
When asked about the plans for the barn's current renovation, Alice was excited.
I love it because I'm sure the spirits are still there. There's a nice feel in that building, and I like that. It probably, when I was little, was the hub to all of the college, and then it became more of a spoke, but it was still part of the entity. So I'm glad they're not just saying, oh, you've served your time, you're done. I'm glad they're letting it be reborn.
Barnyards is a production of Utah State University's Museum of Anthropology and College of Humanities and Social Sciences, with help from the Utah Humanities Council and Utah Public Radio. To find out more, check out our blog online at usubarn.blogspot.com.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
Epigenetics is a rapidly growing research field that investigates heritable changes in gene expression that do not alter the genetic code. It literally means above the genome. At its most basic, the epigenome is the master puppeteer controlling how genes act, and this can be good and bad news.
First, the bad news. Evidence shows lifestyle choices, such as eating too much, can leave epigenetic marks on your DNA that cause obesity genes to express themselves in future generations. Also, exposure in the womb to toxins in the environment can lead to diseases and disorders that are passed on to offspring for several generations to come. And your bad behaviors can predispose your kids, even before they're conceived, to disease and an early death. Randy Jertle is professor of pathology at Duke University in North Carolina. He is at the forefront of epigenetics and working to speed up the momentum of the field in the scientific community and the media.
To me, it's a story. I'm telling a story with people. So the storyline here is really actually pretty simple, but it's immense in its breadth, I think. And that is, in evolution, Mendel said that there's selection, positive or negative, for variations, basically. But where do these variations come from? The emphasis has always been on genetic changes causing these variations, and then they give rise to variation in characteristics, phenotypes, then can be selected for or against. But there's another type of way in which you can get variation, and that is through epigenetic changes, programs, changes in the programs that give rise to variation also. And it's becoming clearer that both, not only are genetic changes involved in creating these variations that are selected for and ultimately even give rise to different species, but that epigenetic changes are also very, very important in creating a different type of variation. So if we are here, and in fact we rode, in other words, humans or any animal species, rode into this present time, in effect on the back of epigenetic variations and not just genetic variations, then it doesn't take a rocket scientist very long to realize that when you alter these epigenetic programs that give rise to these variations through environmental exposures, etc., that has a great potential now of creating what we call diseases like cancer and neurological disorders like schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disease, etc.
There is some good news coming out of all the research. Scientists are figuring out how to manipulate epigenetic marks in the lab, which is leading to the development of new drugs that will treat illness by silencing bad genes and turning on good ones. The hope is we will learn how to flick a biochemical switch that will turn off genes that play a role in many diseases, including cancer, autism, diabetes, and others. Since the 1970s, epigenetics has been an occasional sidekick to genetics. Now scientists are realizing it has the potential to explain a lot of the gray areas in science. And those that are true believers say a major paradigm shift is on the horizon, where epigenetics will take center stage in biology and medicine.
Michael Skinner, professor of biological sciences at Washington State University, is on the front lines with Randy Jertl, defending new ground despite the skeptics who are reluctant to follow a totally new school of thought.
Now, Washington State is now one of the largest reproductive groups in the world because we really helped build that sort of up. But I'm one of very few people in the university that does any epigenetics. And so it's a great supportive environment for reproduction, but there's a void in terms of epigenetics. We're one of the few labs that does it intensely. That's not necessarily abnormal. Most universities really at this stage only have a few people that do heavy-duty epigenetics. It's not a common field yet. And so you see one or two people at most universities. It's not that there's just big clusters of epigenetics people. There's a couple of examples of that, but it's not sort of thing. And in fact, epigenetics is an area that a lot of people, particularly geneticists, see as conflicting. And so most of us that got into the field, you know, a while back, we ran into opposition for doing epigenetics because it didn't fall in the lines of the current paradigm of genetic determinism. And epigenetics doesn't do that. Epigenetics solves some of the problems of, you know, the failures of genetic determinism. So what that did for many of us is we had opposition more internally than anything else, which we had to deal with.
Skinner's principal focus is systems biology, a biology-based interdisciplinary field that focuses on complex interactions in biological systems. Systems biology claims that it uses a new perspective, holism instead of reductionism, in looking at environmental impacts, phenotypic changes, and impacts on evolution and disease.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of us in the field that basically have had to deal with oppositions within our home institutions to a fairly great degree, because we were not doing the current paradigm of science of genetics. And it's getting better nationwide or worldwide, but still there's a fairly big opposition by classic geneticists for epigenetics. And currently the paradigm in science is genetic determinism. So that's the concept that everything in biology comes from the basic DNA sequence and determinism. So from your phenotypes that you have, evolutionary biology, disease states, no matter what you think about, the concept of the current paradigm is it's genetic abnormalities that's the causal factor. Well, clearly, if you look at epidemiology over the past 40 years, there are significant areas in science that don't fit that paradigm. But because we've spent well over 50, 60 years training people in genetics, having that paradigm be the principal sort of thing going forward, having the administrators like the director of NIH and so forth that really have that sort of paradigm, to break that paradigm is a fairly significant thing. So epigenetics, and this particularly environmental epigenetics like this meeting has put out, is definitely requires a paradigm shift, because no longer does the genetics alone promote all of biology. And it's a cooperation between environment, epigenetics, and genetics that gives you the overall system in terms of how things work. But there's a lot of geneticists that sort of resent that, because most of them have been in business for 20, 30 years. And to have something late in their career come along and say, well, wait a second, genetics is not the whole story here. You know, there's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to that. But that's what we're in right now, is a paradigm shift going from sort of genetic determinism to a broader sort of perspective, which environment and epigenetics provides a mechanism to explain a great deal of biology that couldn't be explained by genetics.
Mendelian genetics, or classical genetics, based on Mendel's laws of inheritance, where the expression of traits can be predicted based on mathematical probabilities, has governed scientific thought since the late 18th century. Whereas the field of epigenetics, which has been around for about 70 years, is still in its early stages, both in research and in acceptance.
There's not one or the other. Both of these types of problems are going to ultimately give rise to the things that we're focusing on right now, which is diseases and disorders in humans.
Today, most scientists accept epigenetics as truth, and it has changed how they look at the mechanisms of evolution and disease. However, because epigenetics rattles classic thought and requires a major shift in thinking, for some, it still hasn't caught on and often eludes the public.
The field of epigenetics developed sort of in the late 40s, early 50s by Conrad Waddington and several other people at the time. But then because it didn't fit classic genetics, particularly Mendelian genetics, it was put aside. It wasn't until the mid-70s that molecular mechanisms started to fill in exactly how epigenetics works, DNA methylation, things like that. And it wasn't until the late 80s that things like exon activation, or 90s when imprinting was identified. So there weren't defined epigenetic processes until then. And then it probably wasn't until maybe 2000 that there really was a pretty good appreciation, early in the mid-90s maybe, when histone modifications and other sort of epigenetic marks sort of started to be identified. So it's really only been in the last 10 years, 15 years, that we have had the molecular elements of epigenetics well-defined. Once that became defined and the technology started to be improved, that's when we started to actually push the paradigm. So I would sort of say that the big push didn't start maybe 10, 12 years ago, and we're just in the early phases. It may take 10 or 20 years to actually get this paradigm shift to actually come into place. This meeting is very encouraging because you see a lot of younger generation scientists, you know, grasping this, because they are not prejudiced towards genetics necessarily, and they understand that a cooperation between epigenetics and genetics actually does explain more science than just genetics alone. So that's where we're sort of at. We may have to have a generation sort of come up to actually shift the paradigm completely. But we're in the very early stages. And those of us that have been in the field for the past 10 years, 15 years, it's been a pretty big fight.
Traditionally, science has developed in two philosophical areas. The first is reductionism, where you take something and break it down into individual parts to explain how it works. That has been the principal and classic approach to science. This philosophy lends to the concept of genetic determinism that has dominated genetics for the last 50 years plus.
The genetic determinism says the bottom base element is DNA, and everything comes up from the DNA in terms of how things work. So that's called a reductionist genetic determinism philosophy. It is predominant in society, in scientific society today.
The alternate philosophy, systems biology, instead of going from the bottom up, you go from the top down. It is basically stating the organism as a whole, the top part, is more than a sum of its parts, and this supports a concept called emergence. Emergence gives the organism a much higher order structure and function than just the individual parts in and of themselves.
You could compare this idea to a song composed of many parts, starting with a bass line, and then each instrument, like a snare drum, which layer upon layer becomes a song, and then it plays in your car, loud, on a warm summer night with the top down, and it becomes far more than a sum of its parts, but rather a whole experience.
Systems biology until 10, 15 years ago. We couldn't do genome-wide sort of analysis. We couldn't look at a system in sort of a global level like we can today. So slowly what's happening, this is a different paradigm shift. So you have this genetic, epigenetic sort of shift going on. But now you have this different paradigm shift going from systems biology to reductionist types of biology going on as well.
So currently, some scientists favor a reductionist method, where other scientists are sold on the newer systems biology approach. The two philosophies exist side by side as competing approaches to understanding complex afflictions, such as disease.
For example, in trying to determine the cause of a neurodegenerative disease, the reductionists would try to break the disease down to a single gene by knocking out a gene or manipulating it to see if it will influence the onset of the disease or prevent it entirely, trying to disassemble it down to the simplest parts possible. A systems biologist would look at the organism's genome as a whole.
What we're finding is the systems approaches are far more productive in giving us information. You examine every single gene in the genome, and in this particular case, every single epigenetic mark in the genome, you put that together to understand what's the difference between the disease state in that genome-wide level versus the control undisease state. And that gives you the basic information to understand on the whole system level how the disease develops. Both of them are useful, and both of them have been productive. But I think in the future, we're going to move towards a philosophy where systems biology becomes much more predominant than a reductionist genetic determinism. Epigenetics falls in the middle there. It's helping us understand how systems work independent of these parts like the DNA. And so it's sort of in the middle of all this. So this is sort of the philosophical paradigm shift that's occurring in biology or science today as well.
And in order to shift to a systems biology approach, the whole animal model system currently used will have to change. Today, the mice most used in labs are not effective for epigenetic research. The inbred homogenous mice are not diverse enough to provide the bigger picture.
Because of the genetic determinism philosophy, what they've done is inbred a large number of mouse lines so that they are homogeneous genetically. So ideally, these mice are really perfect to do genetic studies, and that's why they were designed. However, they are inbred and purely genetic and homogeneous to do genetics. But the problem is those lines oftentimes don't provide the best biology. Organisms generally have a certain amount of biological variation, and inbreeding actually can compromise the genome on a molecular level. So the better models to do biology, not genetics, but biology and phenotypes and how environment affects biology and so forth, are outbred lines of animals. And mice, in general, are much more inbred than, let's say, rats. The outbred rats are much more outbred. They're much more sort of basic biological systems are sort of normal in the sense that they're not inbred. So that's why I chose rats over mice. And there is going to be as it's already starting, a big push regarding the animal models. And so right now the general scientific society uses mouse models, and I think we're going to see over the next 10 years is they're going to realize there's major limitations with those mouse models, in particular when you want to do epigenetics, because environmental epigenetics doesn't work well on inbred lines of animals, whether it's a mouse or a rat. So I think this is going to be part of this shift going from genetic determinism to systems more approach, is this model system change as well. But no, it's not going to shift real quick.
Yeah.
And so the funding agencies and the commercial agencies that sell the mice and so forth are really, you know, they push the mice.
Mm-hmm.
And until we actually convince the scientific community as to why scientifically the inbred lines are limited when you try to do epigenetics and basic physiology type studies, it's going to take some time. They just assume that the inbred lines are best. Because if you think about it on a genetics level, it is a better model for genetics. But if genetics is not the whole story, then you run up against a problem.
Straight Mendelian genetics still govern the ideas of genetic inheritance as well. And Skinner says genetics can fall short in many instances, especially when explaining the proliferation of human disease, changes in male sperm, and even in evolution.
The current concept in biology is the primary mechanism for inheritance, heritability, is Mendelian genetics, that we have this genetic inheritance that basically follows Mendelian, you know, rules regarding inheritance. And there's certain mechanisms and sort of phenotypes associated with Mendelian genetics that people look at. And that's been in place for the past 100 years. Mechanistically in place for the past 40, 50 years. And this is why the society, they'll say, you know, if you have a certain phenotype, blue eyes or a certain color hair or whatever else, that's a genetic process being passed down from your parents or your grandparents. And so if there's a nice genetic sort of Mendelian sort of phenotype associated with that. However, there's a great deal of, in particular, environmental sciences, environmental factors that have impacts on biology that can influence inheritance that can't be explained through normal Mendelian genetics. And this has been known for 30, 40 years by epidemiologists that have told us that here's populations or here's phenotypes, here's things happening that can't be explained through normal genetics or normal Mendelian genetics. The first is, for example, if you take and look at disease anywhere in the world, there's different disease frequencies in different parts of the world. And if you take someone early in life from one area and you move them to another region, they will develop the disease frequency of that region they move to. Well, if it was genetics, that wouldn't be possible. It clearly has to be an environmentally induced thing. We also know that for disease states, the amount of disease that can be attributed to genetic mutations for almost most major diseases is extremely low. Sometimes only a few percent, sometimes 5 or 10%. But the majority of disease cannot be explained through sort of genetic mutations and so forth. Again, suggesting there has to be some potentially environmental factor that actually might be associated with this. We've also seen dramatic rises in disease over the past 20 or 30 years. Identical twins have different disease frequencies, even though they're supposedly genetically similar. Okay? And evolutionarily, the same organism in two parts of the world can actually evolve differently based on environmental impacts. So there's a lot of biology that doesn't fit normal Mendelian inheritance and genetics, and it's environmentally influenced. So with that sort of the preamble, it suggests there has to be something else besides just the basic DNA sequence regulating genome activity. And there has to be some sort of conduit for the environment. Well, that turns out to be epigenetics. So epigenetics are things around the DNA that can regulate genome activity independent of DNA sequence. And the epigenetics is actually quite responsive to the environment, whereas genetics and DNA sequence is not. Now, what we've found is that if you take an environmental factor, it can be an environmental compound. We've used environmental compounds, but you can use nutrition, you can use a number of different types of things. And if you expose a gestating mother during a critical time of development when the gonad, the testis or the ovary, in particular case the testis, is developing, undergoing sex determination, turns out that the germline that's going to turn into the sperm or the egg is developing there as well. And so this environmental exposure can reprogram the development of the germline by changing its epigenome. And then the sperm, in this particular case, gets permanently programmed. And so then the individual that develops, as soon as they reproduce to the next generation, that shift in the epigenome of the sperm gets transferred to the next generation. And because it's permanent, it keeps going for generations to come. And so what you've done is you've actually shifted the baseline programming of the sperm permanently, and it gets transferred. We've taken it out four or five generations. In the absence of any environmental exposure after the initial exposure of the gestating mother. So that's called a transgenerational phenomena and transgenerational inheritance. It does not follow Mendelian genetics. And it turns out what's happened is the sperm in this particular case, the epigenome, the DNA methylate, the sites in the DNA that get sort of chemically modified with the methylation groups, that those get shifted. So that the shift in the epigenome in the sperm then promotes a shift in the biology of the offspring. This usually is associated with more adult onset disease and different sort of phenotypes. And because it's permanent, the next generation gets the same thing and so forth. And so we have diseases like breast cancer or prostate disease or kidney disease coming up. And it comes up for four or five generations in a row, all going through this epigenetic transgenerational inheritance. So what this does is it actually provides a brand new mechanism for inheritance that hasn't been really appreciated. And the key thing is it's an environmentally induced process. And so that means environmental factors can affect your phenotypes, what kind of phenotypes you have, what kind of diseases you're going to have going forward. Now, for disease development, this is a big deal because this could explain why disease can increase over several generations at a very dramatic rate that can't be explained by genetics, but it can be explained by epigenetics and transgenerational sort of things.
Skinner says epigenetics can also explain evolutionary biology. If you have a population of animals that experience an environmental insult, this shifts their phenotype or appearance, which manifests in at least four or five generations forward. Skinner is suggesting that a change in environment can result in altered genetic code, resulting in a split in this population of animals, or in other words, creating a fork in the road, taking them down separate evolutionary paths.
You shift their phenotype through a transgenerational epigenetic mechanism, such that this population is exposed and this population isn't. With time, they will potentially evolve down a different lineage. So it can explain mechanistically some of the things we've seen in biology that we could not explain through classic sort of genetic mechanisms. So this transgenerational epigenetics provides a mechanism to sort of a new mechanism to consider in terms of inheritance, may explain a number of sort of things that genetics can't explain about disease development and basic biology.
Skinner's studies using rats are showing the power of environment over gene expression and how the mechanisms of transgenerational inheritance can work differently in males and females.
So we have a number of different compounds now we've identified that can promote this epigenetic transgenerational inheritance through reprogramming basically the germline or what's going to turn into the sperm. And it goes through the male line, so the fathers pass it on to the next generation. The diseases we see transgenerationally in the rat model that we use is something like the males and females are getting mammary tumors, sort of breast cancer sort of thing. They develop prostate disease, a very large percentage, maybe up to 50% of the males actually develop prostate disease. Kidney disease in about 40% of the rate. We have male infertility in terms of testes not functioning properly. We also have some immune abnormalities where they actually develop sort of immune abnormalities. And so those are major diseases sort of to consider, and that's basically the limit of what we looked at now. If we look farther, we probably could get more. and approximately 85% of our animals develop at least one or more disease. And so it's an extremely high rate of disease being induced by environmental factors. And it's not in the individual exposed necessarily. It occurs in their great-great-grandchildren that never see exposure.
And it's not through the female?
Right. So far, most of the studies we have, we've shown a paternal or a male sort of transmission through the sperm. And the females, although the females of a male carrying it develop disease, the females can't necessarily transfer it to the next generation in our model systems. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen. It's just that we have not seen it. I suspect that potentially other compounds may go through the female. But the female developmental systems is slightly different than the male, and I think the female germline, the egg, may be more protected from environmental insult than the sperm is.
That was Michael Skinner, professor of biology at Washington State University. Skeptics say much more research in this area is needed before profound implications are made. But if Skinner's and other epigeneticists' findings hold true, not only will their work shed light on evolutionary processes and the tenets of Mendelian genetics, it will also influence chemicals regulation, nutrition, prenatal care, and the treatment of chronic diseases.
But to change the medical community, to change to do the paradigm shift from where it stands currently will probably take longer than the actual science. And so I would hope that it would only be 10 or 20 years based on the technology advances and so forth. And I think, the faster we can show successes to do that type of thing, the faster it'll actually occur. But it's not going to be a quick fix just in the next few years, that's for sure.
Stay tuned with SQ Radio for our ongoing series on this burgeoning field, an exciting movement in genetics and science.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.
Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Hi, this is UPR Development Director Brian Earle. The Utah Public Radio Spring Pledge Drive begins next Tuesday, and I need help with the voluminous calls that I just know will be coming into the station with pledges of support. You only need to have good verbal skills and the ability to use a keyboard. Join us for 1 hour or as many as you'd like. You'll have fun as you get to know familiar UPR voices as well as your fellow public radio listeners. To volunteer, just go to upr.org and click on the volunteer link. That's upr.org. Thanks.